some of the things we're going to talk about this morning in the lesson. And my daughter looks at me and she says, "So, Dad, are you nervous?" And I said, "No, Evan, of course not. It's not till tomorrow." This is a bit different from me. In another Evan story. In fact, Evan's probably more nervous than I am. But yeah, you know, this is a little nerve-wracking because it's a little different than what I'm used to. But we were having dinner earlier in the week, and the subject came up about getting ready for the lesson. And Evan's like, "Dad, can you do that?" And I stopped and said, "Evan, what do I do for a living?" And she's like, "Well..." And I said, I had to explain, you know, at least the goal of what I do is to get in front of a jury of 12 people and get up and talk in front of them. And so, you know, talking in front of people is part of what's in my job responsibilities. Now, it's a little different because when I get up in front of juries, I'm motivated by two things. I'm motivated by an intense desire to win. I'm a highly competitive person. I hate to lose. And so when I get up in front of them, I'm motivated by not wanting to lose. And I'm also motivated by not wanting to look stupid. It's a highly effective motivator for me. Well, there's no winning here, so I'm only motivated by the desire not to look stupid. So that'll get us wherever it gets us. But it's also a little different for me because this is a different type of speaking. I've done it before. In fact, you know, as I grew up, my dad would have me provide sermons every now and then. But the difference then was he used to write them. And now I have to write my own material. And so we'll see how it all goes. But I've been watching. I've been learning. I've been watching Dan. I know you have to have a tablet. And so I've got my tablet up here to follow along. Actually, this easy lesson was pretty easy to come up with, at least conceptually. You know, I read chapter 8 in the story. And the things that are in there, just have some very clear applications for us. In fact, there's three really clear points I think we can take as we move into, as a congregation, selecting our leadership and selecting or setting the direction of the church here. And so that's what I want to do this morning. I want to look at some things we can get as we set our course for our congregation. And I want to look at these points in the context of a woman, a Weezer, and a Weckless nitwit. Sorry, I tried and tried to come up with a W word, a descriptive term, and the best that I could come up with was it like a speech impediment for an R. But you know, I'm trying to keep the alliteration going there. So to set the stage, we're in chapter 8, and we're dealing with the judges. The Israelites have moved into the promised land. Moses brought them in, or Moses didn't get to bring them in, but he got them poised. Joshua led them in. The Lord gave them many victories. They took over lands. Joshua led the people, but now he's died, and Israel falls into a pattern. And this pattern kind of sticks with them over and over throughout their history. They're faithful for a while. Things go well, but then they forget God, and other nations come in and oppress them. After they've forgotten God and people come in and oppress, God raises up a leader, and they resume their faithfulness for a while, only to fall back into their sinful nature. And so in Judges, we see various leaders coming up. We start with Othniel, Ehud, and I'm a little miffed about the story's treatment of Ehud because, you know, he's clearly one of the great men of the Bible. He's left-handed. And they just kind of brush past that. So, you know, go back to Judges and read about Ehud. You'll be very blessed. And then we get to this in page 105 of the story. We see this. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at that time. Now wait a minute. This is Israel. This is God's people we're talking about. When did Deborah become a man's name? It says, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at that time. She held court under the palm of Deborah, and the Israelites went up to her to have their disputes decided. Now, this isn't Judge Judy that we're talking about. I mean, she's not deciding a dispute because a dog was reading the newspaper on somebody else's lawn. This is real people. It's real disputes and problems. And they're going to this woman and she's telling them what to do. And it's not just the women that are going. It's all of the Israelites. She's in a position of authority. She's got their respect and they're submissive to her. In fact, she has so much respect and authority that she's leading the entire nation. And we're not just talking about any nation here. This is God's people. This is God. This is the deity that created man first and then woman. It's the deity that created woman from man. This is the deity that for hundreds and hundreds of years has presided over a patriarchal society. This is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not Sarah, Rebecca, Leah, and Rachel. And yet Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, is leading Israel at that time. What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here? Now, see, this is funny because what's happening here is you've got a guy, a cowboy on a horse, who's riding up and he's saying, what in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here? And the shows haven't been invented yet. So see, that's why that's funny. Had these people not read 1 Timothy chapter 2, 11, where Paul says, I do not permit a woman to have authority over a man? I mean, I could just kind of picture Paul sitting as a boy, sitting in Jewish governmental history class, and they get to the subject of Deborah being leading Israel. And it had to have made his head explode. That's the only thing I can, I wonder how he dealt with that. But put yourselves in the shoes of the Israelite men here for a minute. They've always been ruled by men. And you know, really, in that society, women were second-class citizens. They valued boys. They valued sons. They gave away the women time and time again. Yet, here we are. These men have a dispute with each other, and who are they going to go to? They're going to go to this second-class citizen to have a female judge decide their dispute. Now, I tried to come up with some illustrations, some things that's comparable, that might be comparable in our minds to try to bring this home. And I came up with one or two, and I'd ask Rhonda about them, and her response was always, you know, if you have to ask, and that's not the illustration you want to use. So I've got, you know, I'm not touching that. But just keep in mind, this is not the situation that these guys probably thought they were going to be in. And it gets worse for them. Because Deborah's leadership went way beyond just deciding their dispute. She's the commander of the military. Page 105 in the story. We see that the Israelites, they did evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, king of Canaan. And a guy named Sisera, the commander of the king's army, has 900 chariots fitted with iron. And he's been cruelly oppressing the Israelites for 20 years. And so she's going to deal with this. And so she brings out Barak. And she tells Barak to go, take up with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun and lead them up to Mount Tabor. And I will lead Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with all his chariots and all his troops to the Kishon River, and I will give them into your hands. And so then Barak says to her, if you go with me, I will go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go. And she says, certainly I will go with you, but because of the course you are taking, the honor will not be yours, for the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. Now, don't you know Deborah knew exactly what she was saying there? I mean, she's gigging him. I mean, I can just imagine her, you know, sticking that knife in and twisting. You, Barak, you military man, your honor is going to go to a woman. And that's exactly what happened. We read later on that the Israelites fight. Sisera flees. He hides in the tent of a woman named Jael, and she puts a tent peg right through his hand, right through his head, and the honor goes to her. But what really is going on here? God installing a woman to lead Israel during this period of time. Well, I think it's because none of the men were doing their job. Reread on page 105 that the Israelites were doing evil in the eyes of the Lord, and they'd been doing it for 20 years.
And perhaps her position itself, having this leadership position over the Israelites, was a judgment on the weak-willed men of Israel. There's some evidence of that as we read as some of what we just read. Because of the course you are taking, the honor will not be yours. Sisera will be delivered into the hands of a woman. In some sense, I think that refers to Barak individually, but it's symbolic of the Israelites in general. Because of the course that they're taking, God has given the honor to a woman. Now, what does this mean for us? Well, I think the thing that we really want to draw from this as a congregation and where we are right now is this, that God will use whomever he needs to use to accomplish his purpose. And it might be somebody that, you know, at least if we're not really expecting, someone that doesn't occur to us to be someone that God would use. We just saw one in a couple chapters back in the story with Rahab the prostitute. When the spies go and they're looking at Jericho and Rahab hides them out in her house, and we really don't think of God using a prostitute for his work, but he did. In the New Testament, Matthew, the tax collector. Here's somebody that's hated more than lawyers. They're looked at as crooks, but you know, Jesus chose Matthew and he used him. Saul is another example. Saul was a persecutor of Christians. This is a guy who's invoking, the invocation of his name scared people to death. And God converts him on the road to Damascus. But after that happens, even then, he goes to the disciples, and the disciples, they don't want to have anything to do with this guy. They think, how in the world could God possibly be using him? But yet God did, not what the people expected. Now, I don't think we've got any prostitutes or any crooks or any persecutors in our congregation, but God might be calling someone to fill a role that makes us go, really? That's the person that's going to fill this role? You know, when we were submitting forms for elders last week, my family and I my family was filling ours out, and our first choice was Hannah. And so we were going to put Hannah down on our list. And you know, we've got biblical precedent, we thought, with Deborah. But seriously, we need to be open to the idea that God may want to use someone that just seems a little bit odd to us. And there's a flip side to that. You may think you're not the right person to serve in some particular role. Yet, you may be precisely the person that God's chosen. And as unlikely as it might seem to you, God might be calling you into the role of a deacon. He may be calling you to the role of an elder. He may be wanting to use you to teach. He might be wanting you to lead worship. He might be calling you to go visit other people. He might be calling you to lead a sermon whenever you don't lead sermons. Who knows? But don't close your minds based on what you think your limitations are or based on how you think others look at you. God might just have something in store that you aren't expecting. So after Deborah, we have 40 years of peace, and then we see that Israel did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years gave them into the hands of the Midianites, which leads us to the next part. The power of Midian was so oppressive that the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, the Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep, nor cattle, nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count them or their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. The Midianites were a real problem, and so God decides that it's time to do something about them. And he decides he's going to raise up a new leader to defeat them. And so then we turn to page 108 and we see how this comes about. An angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "Pardon me, my Lord," Gideon replied, "but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian." Then the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" And I think Gideon heard these words, "The strength that you have, go in the strength that you have." And he said, "Pardon me, my Lord, but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." Now think about this for a minute. The battles, the way that battles are depicted from ancient times. I mean, if you saw the movie, the movie about Moses that came out a few months ago, and they depicted some of the battles that the Egyptians fought under Moses and Pharaoh's son. The way they depict those is that the leaders, they're the ones out in front. They're leading these guys, these whole large army of men, into battle for this hand-to-hand combat. And I think that's accurate. That's the way that it happens. So the men follow this leader into battle. He's out in front. This is a powerful, strong man. He's probably the best fighter among them. And the armies are led by these figures that are larger than life. But yet, look what Gideon says about himself. "Pardon me, my Lord, but my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least of my family." Gideon, he's the weakest of the weak. He's the last guy to get picked when the kids all get together and choose up sides for their football game. You remember those days back when you were a kid, you know, you'd have a couple team captains, and they were always the big, strong, fast, you know, able to run and tackle and throw and do everything. They would be the captains, and they'd choose their teams. And so they'd start going through through all the guys, and there's always the guy that everybody knows is going to be the last to be chosen. And he is. He's the last. And sometimes there's an odd number. So, you know, whoever gets this last guy, he's going to go to a team that's going to have more than anybody else. But they don't care because he's so bad. You know, that's all right. All right, we'll take him. That's Gideon. You know, my childhood, there was this scrawny, you know, kind of unathletic, asthmatic kid. And he was the kid that was always picked last. We called him Weezer. That's okay. We called him that to his face. Gideon is Weezer, okay? And he's going to be the team captain. He's going to be the guy leading them out there. And what do we just say? God will use whoever he needs to use to accomplish his purpose. So Gideon gathers up an army to fight the Midianites. And he gathers up 32,000 men. Now the experts tell us that there were 135,000 Midianites. I don't know where they got that number from, but let's go with it. 135,000. So I started to try to think this week, well, what does that look like whenever you have 135,000 people against 32,000 people? Well, what some visual image of that. And so here's what I thought of. Evan, bring up the first slide here. This is Skelly Stadium. All right, this is where TU plays football. And you know, those of you that know the stadium know this is before they built the renovation on the end. But this serves our purpose. This is roughly 30,000 people. Okay? This is what that looks like. Now, this group of people, this, you know, roughly 30,000 people, take that size group and add to it this. This is the University of Michigan's football stadium that seats 110,000. That's what these guys were up against. And yet, God says, Gideon, you got too many folks. Pardon me, my Lord? That's what I would be saying. He said, tell everybody that's afraid that they can go home. Now, think about this for a minute. Judges tells us that the Midianites were camped in the valley below the Israelites. So all these people, these 32,000, they can look down. They're looking at this, and they're knowing they got to fight this. And, you know, that's a lot of people that they got to go up against. This is hand-to-hand combat. They don't have any technically advanced weapons. And they're going to be led into battle by Weezer. Now, 22,000 of those folks said, yep, I'm out of here. I'm gone. That's it. And it left them with this. All right, this is you know, 8,000-10,000 people. And they're going to go up against Michigan Stadium. But yet God says, you still got too many. Now, I'm surprised that there were still 10,000 people left there. I mean, really, what was the matter with those guys? I don't know. I think maybe it says something about their faith, or maybe they're just deranged. But whatever it is, they're still there. So God tells Gideon, you've got too many. So now we're going to apply the lapdog test, or the lapping dog test. And so what he told Gideon to do is take the men down to get a drink, and all of the men who get down on their knees and reach down to the water to get their drink, send them home. Anybody that laps the water up out of their hands like a dog, you're going to keep those. Now, some people have suggested that that process identified who the better soldiers were. Because what they do whenever they're, you know, drinking from their hand, their eyes are up and they can keep an eye on their surroundings. And so that's a way that Gideon was able to tell these are the people who will be better in battle. But I think that misses the point of the story. You know, the point of the story is not that God is picking the 300 best. He's just calling the number down. He doesn't care which 300. He just wants a small number of people. And so he gets it down to 300, and Michigan Stadium is now going to fight this. You ever get the idea that God has a flair for the dramatic? I mean, you know, we've got the burning bush, we've got the Red Sea, we've got the prophets of Baal, we've got the day of Pentecost and the fire coming down on everybody. Now we've got 300 people are going to go up against Michigan Stadium. You know, if I were in that 300, I think I'd be saying, hey, Gideon, can we go back to that option about letting all the scared people go home again? Because I'd be ready to go. But he's going to take these 300 men. He's going to have them fight. You know, and God's plans often, I mean, it's an impossible thing to think about, but God's plans often seem impossible in the eyes of men. And what's happening, obviously, is clearly God doesn't want there to be any doubt. It's his power at work. He sets up a situation where no one gets the idea that it was anything but God that defeated the Midianites. And he's got these 300 that trust in him, and he's going to do something absolutely amazing with them. But before he does, it's interesting what happens with Gideon. Gideon's still not quite sure. You know, God, give me, you know, can you give me another sign? You know, can you make the fleece wet and everything else dry? Can you make everything else dry and make the fleece wet? Now, he was concerned, even though I think he trusted God. And I think, you know, this illustrates that you know, we still have doubts, or people can still have doubts, even when they have faith and trust. And what does God do with Gideon? You know, it's interesting. He doesn't chastise him. He puts him at ease. He makes the ground wet and the fleece dry. He makes the fleece dry and fleece wet and the ground dry. He reveals to him that the Midianites have had dreams and that they know what's coming. And I think this shows us that when God asks us to do hard things for him, he's still there to guide us. He's still there to help us, and he's still there to encourage us. So, of course, God uses the 300 Midianites. They defeat the land, and there is peace for 40 years. So the thing that I think we ought to take from this morning that applies to us is that the strength of God's people does not lie in numbers. You know, sometimes I think large size can be a hindrance to God's work. It's harder, or it can be harder, to rely on God when you've got a lot of resources. Years ago, Rhonda and I were at a church that really needed a new building. And we didn't have enough resources to build one or acquire another one. And God started doing some really amazing things. It started with a family in the congregation who had acquired a lot of wealth through the stock market. they were nearing, or at least one of them was nearing the end of their life, and they decided that they wanted to give that money to God, and so they give that money to the church. And when I say a significant amount of money, I mean about $450,000. They take that, the elders take that $450,000 and prayed about it, got the congregation to pray about it, and through some programs, people contribute, and now the church has $900,000. They took the $900,000. They found some land that they could buy. It was about, 40, 60 acres? I think something like that. I think it was 60 acres of land. Purchase price was $900,000. They go out, they buy the land. We don't have the money to build the building, but hey, we've got a $900,000 asset that God has given to us. And, you know, we will take the money and go buy the land. We'll let God deal with how he's going to put the building on it. And that was literally the attitude that they had. We're just going to, you know, we don't know where it's going to come from. We don't know where how the money's going to be there. But we think God wants us to have this building, and we're going to rely on him to provide it. Well, as they're going through the process of acquiring the 60 acres, they realize that they've got a buyer for 20 of it. And they don't need, obviously, 60 acres. And they're able to sell off the 20 acres for $1 million. So now they've got 40 acres and $1 million. And you can just see God working in all this. And it's obvious that it's because people are putting their trust in him. But the people got antsy. Now we've got this land. We want to get the building. Let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go. We want to do it. And so what they did is they stopped relying on God. They went out. They decided we can borrow the money. We can make this happen ourselves. And the building got built, but the church kind of faltered from then. And it went on a decline for 15 years or more. And I'm convinced that when the resources weren't there, they didn't have the ability to do it themselves. They relied on God. God blessed them. But once they realized, okay, now we've got resources, and now we're at the point where we can do it on our own, that's when things started going south. So I think whenever we've got situations where we have to rely on God, and that's exactly what God created with Israel against the Midianites, he's much better poised to work. And maybe that's just what we've got here. God's got us pared down to a small size. And maybe he's done that for a purpose. You know, maybe he's doing it to get us to rely on him, and he's got something in store for us. We don't know what it is. We aren't looking at the teeth of the Midianites, fortunately, but there's something there. And whatever we accomplish from here is going to come from our reliance on his strength, not from ours. So there's peace for 40 years. And we go through several leaders, and then again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. And then it's time for God to raise someone up to take the lead in delivering Israel from the Philistines, and that person is Samson. So on page 12, we read about the birth of Samson, a man named Zorah. A man of Zorah named Manoah had a wife who was childless, unable to give birth. That's interesting. See another childless woman that God's going to use. And the angel of the Lord appeared to her and said, "You are barren and childless, but you are going to become pregnant and give birth to a son. Now see to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink, and that you do not eat anything unclean. You will become pregnant and have a son whose head is never to be touched by a razor, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, dedicated to God from the womb. He will take the lead in delivering Israel from the hands of the Philistines." Now, when we think of Samson, the first thing that comes to mind is the hair and the strength of the hair. And I want to talk about that for just a second. And I want to go back to this idea of what the angel's saying. He's going to be a Nazarite. What's a Nazarite? Well, number 6, God tells Moses about this special vow for people that are Nazarites. Number 6, chapter 1, or verse 1 says, "The Lord said to Moses, speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man or woman wants to make a special vow, a vow of separation to the Lord as a Nazarite, he must abstain from wine and other fermented drink, and must not drink vinegar made from wine or other fermented drink. He must not drink grape juice or eat grapes or raisins. As long as he is a Nazarite, he must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, not even the seeds or skins. During the period of his vow of separation, no razor may be used on his head. He must be holy until the period of his separation to the Lord is over. He must let the hair of his head grow long. Throughout the period of separation to the Lord, he must not go near a dead body," and it goes on and on. "Throughout the period of his separation, he is consecrated to the Lord." And there's more about the hair. In verse 9, "If someone dies suddenly in his presence, thus defiling the hair he has dedicated, he must shave his head on the day of his cleansing, the seventh day." Verse 18 talks about sacrifices that the Nazarite would make. He says, "Then at the entrance to the tent of meeting, the Nazarite must shave off the hair that he dedicated. He is to take the hair and put it in the fire that is under the sacrifice of the fellowship offering. After the Nazarite has shaved off the hair of his dedication, the priest is to place in his hands a boiled shoulder of the ram." He goes on and describes more about the sacrifice. But there's just these repeated references to the hair. And you know, with Samson, what we often talk about is that the hair is the source of his strength. But I don't think that's quite exactly right. I don't think the strength comes from his hair. The strength is coming from his dedication to God. And that's what the hair represents. So when he cuts his hair, or if he cuts his hair, that's a sign that the special dedication is over with. And so I think that's what the Nazarite connection there is all about. But anyway, we've got Samson. Now, I picture Samson as this big, strong hulk of a man, you know, just the exact opposite of Gideon. I mean, this is the guy that you want leading into battle. He's the one that you want to be right behind. But he doesn't seem to be quite the brightest guy in the world to me. And he kind of likes to cut up. And in this part, this cracks me up. Samson goes down to Timnah, and there saw a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his father and mother, "I have seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife." His mother and father replied, "Well, isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or among all our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife?" But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me." Now, you know, I read that and I think, this is an arrogant goof. That's the best way I can describe him. And it kind of makes me think of a character, a Disney character, from the story The Beauty and the Beast. And Evan, who am I trying to think of? Can you help me out here? Well, we're supposed to have sound. That wasn't him anyway. No, I'm kidding. This guy Gaston. You know, the lyrics goes, you know, no one fights like Gaston, and you know, no one does all kinds of things like this guy. He's a great, big, strong guy, and all the women fawn over him. All the men want to be him. That's kind of the way that I picture Samson. So Samson and his family head down to Timnah, and on the way, he kills this lion with his bare hands. He goes back later, and there's honey in it, and that leads him to pose a riddle to these companions that he has. He tells them this riddle: out of the eater, something to eat; out of the strong, something sweet. And he tells them, he kind of gambles with them. He says, "Look, if you can tell me what my riddle means, then I'll give you all 30 pieces of clothing. But if you can't, you have to give me 30 pieces of clothing." And so he says, "I'll give you 7 days. That's right. 7 days to solve it." So 3 days go by. The 30 people, they can't figure it out. And so they start trying to find other ways. And on the fourth day, they go to his wife. And they start threatening her. And they make these threats if she doesn't get Samson to explain the riddle. So she goes to Samson. She makes a big scene about how he really doesn't love her. From what I gather about Samson, he's probably standing over there giggling about it all with her the whole time. But finally, on the last day, he tells her what the riddle's about. And then she goes and she tells the people, and they tell Samson the answer. And then we come to what is the most jaw-dropping metaphor in Scripture to me. Samson said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." If you had not plowed with my heifer. Never mind, let's move on. We come to the story of Samson and Delilah. The rulers of the Philistines go into Delilah and they want her to lure Samson into revealing the secret of his strength. And so they offer her silver in order to do it. And she asks him. And so let's take a look at how that kind of goes on page 116. Delilah said to Samson, "Tell me the secret of your great strength, and how can you be tied up and subdued?" Samson answered her, "If anyone ties me with 7 fresh bowstrings that have not been dried, I'll become as weak as any other man." Then the rulers of the Philistines brought her 7 fresh bowstrings that had not been dried, and she tied him with them. With men hidden in the room, she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." But he snapped the bowstrings as easily as a piece of string snaps when it comes close to a flame. So the secret of his strength was not discovered. Then Delilah said to Samson, "You have made a fool of me. You lied to me. Come now, tell me how you can be tied." He said, "If anyone ties me securely with new ropes that have never been used, I'll become as weak as any other man." So Delilah took new ropes and tied him with them. Then with men hidden in the room, she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." But he snapped the ropes off his arms as if they were threads. Delilah said to Samson, "All this time you've been making a fool of me and lying to me. Tell me how you can be tied." He replied, "If you weave the 7 braids of my head into the fabric on the loom and tighten it with the pin, I'll become as weak as any other man." So he was sleeping. While he was sleeping, Delilah took 7 braids of his head, wove them into fabric, and tightened it with the pin. You notice he's getting closer and closer to actually revealing the real thing there. But again she said to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." He awoke from his sleep and pulled up the pin and the loom with the fabric. Then she said to him, "How can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? This is the 3rd time you have made a fool of me and haven't told me the secret of your great strength." With such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was sick to death of it. So he told her everything. Why? Why did he do that? I mean, he knows that she's, whatever it is that he tells her, she goes and she does it. Doesn't she know that if he tells her about his hair, she's going to cut it? I mean, like I said, I think he's just an arrogant goof. You know the rest. She cuts his hair while he's asleep. The Philistines seize him. They gouge out his eyes. They bind him. They put him in prison. And this leads to my last point. If you call your wife a heifer, God help you. You're going to need it. Actually, my last point is this. God's people have to be alert about their weaknesses. Now, this last part, it was a lot easier to write it than it's probably going to be to say it. So I'm just going to say it. We have to know what our weaknesses are, and we've got to protect against them. And that applies whether you hold a formal leadership position or not. Because when we falter, there's a potential for a lot of destruction. And sometimes it's physical destruction, and sometimes it's spiritual destruction. But candidly, in a small congregation like this, that destruction can take on even more significance. And so, you know, I say this to, you know, anybody really, but particularly anybody who's going to be in a leadership positions. we don't really have a lot of options for people to step up and fulfill your role. We need you to do your job, and we need you to protect against your weaknesses. Now, we're all human. I get that. And I'm not saying that our leaders have to be perfect. I'm not saying that they have to not make any mistakes, that they have to not sin. But what I'm saying is we got to know, you have to know where your propensity is to really mess up. And do all you can to steer clear of the things that will cause destruction. So that's what I have to offer you this morning. From a woman, a Weezer, and a Weckless nitwit, God used each of these to lead his people in Canaan, and he rewarded them with victories in the battles that they face. And I think if we put that same reliance on God, despite the numbers that we have and what seems to us like a lack of resources, he will grant us victories in whatever it is that lies ahead of us. So, Jim, I'll turn it back over to you.